the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax. But buckle up and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. My name is Brooke Medina, and today I am joined by a special guest co-host, who is our elections policy analyst, Dr. Andy Jackson. So, Andy, thank you and welcome to the program.
Hey, Brooke, it's always nice to be on.
We are glad to have you here. And Ray is actually, for our listeners' own personal edification, he is out of the office this week. So Andy has agreed graciously to join me in a very interesting, very timely, and inevitably fun discussion on a number of elections-related issues here across the state. But before that, I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge that we are fast approaching Independence Day. And so, Andy, I wanted to talk to you about this a little bit and find out just what was Independence Day, the celebration of it, growing while you were growing up, what was it like?
Well, I grew up in a small, well, at the time it was a small town. Now it's a suburb down in Fuquay Varina, which is a little south of Raleigh on the road to Fayetteville. And so there wasn't a whole lot going on when I was a kid. We had the town fireworks. We did have the parade, so we did that as well. But nothing really extraordinary growing up, just the typical thing mostly. It was a little different when I lived in Nebraska. I just got my PhD a few years ago there. And one thing that's different, I used to think that North Carolinians would make that run to South Carolina, get the fireworks and blow things up here. And we were pretty accomplished in that until I moved to Nebraska. It sounds like a war zone for about a week. They get busloads of fireworks bought locally, shipped in from Missouri, and really from about 9 p.m. to about 2 or 3 a.m. every day for a week, the whole city was lit up.
Oh, my word. So what? That's interesting, because first off, I would not have expected that out of the Midwest, I guess. Like, we're on the East Coast, North Carolina's first in freedom, so I would naturally just assume that we would also be the most boisterous in freedom as well. But yeah, it seems to challenge that notion.
Yeah, you would think so. I kind of liken it to this, there's this old Star Wars episode in the original, not Star Wars, I'm sorry, Star Trek episode in the original series, where they had all these people so nice and so polite. And if you've never been to the Midwest, that whole Midwestern nice thing is real. They're just really, really nice folks. But then that one week a year, they just go completely insane and just make as many explosions as they possibly can. So I think this is a way of kind of being not nice at all for a week, keeping your neighbors up, causing all kinds of mayhem and smoke, you know, coasting down the street. I think it's a nice way for them to kind of blow off their nice.
Right. It's tapping into that revolutionary kind of rebellious spirit, I think.
I guess
pretty
so.
Sure that's what it is. Well, you know, I grew up in Fort Bragg a lot of my life. And so almost every 4th of July, we went just to the field, the parade field over there on base, and watched the fireworks. But it was just such a big to-do being on base like that. We would, my parents, we had a house on base. And so we would have all of our friends that lived in Fayetteville, which is right next to Bragg. And we would have them come over. They'd park in front of our house, and we would grill out. One of my mom's friends would make homemade ice cream. And then we would all, after we had just eaten to our heart's content, we would grab our lawn chairs and we would walk through this little back trail over to the parade field. And that's where we would plant ourselves for hours. And we would listen to the 82nd Airborne Band. We would watch the Golden Knights usually do like a landing. They would do a jump right above the field. And then once it got dark, we would watch the fireworks, and Lee Greenwood's I'm Proud to Be an American would play loud and proud, and my eyes would inevitably fill up with tears. And it was just the best. I just loved it so much.
Yeah.
So anyways, that's just a good bit of nostalgia. But do you have any plans for this 4th of July?
Actually, we on July 3rd, actually, we're heading down to the beach. We usually, our normal spot is over near Fort Fisher, just south of Wilmington. I decided this year I'm going to mix things up a bit, and we're going to hit Fort Macon over near Morehead City.
Yes.
I have a thing for having my beach trips near 19th century forts. I don't know why. So we're going to, unfortunately, the fort is closed to the public. So we're just kind of going to walk the perimeter of the fort, check it out. That fort was built to protect Morehead City from, I assume it was probably built to protect from the British when it was originally made. So we'll check that out and then spend the rest of the day at the beach. And then we might go enjoy some seafood in Morehead City and then head home. The rest of the weekend, we're kind of going to play it by ear.
Yeah. Wow. That sounds like a wonderful, relaxing weekend though. We're actually packing all the kids up and our dog, our big 90-pound golden retriever named Gunner, and we're headed to the western part of the state and going to do Grandfather Mountain, which is by far my favorite spot in all of North Carolina. Just find a lot of tranquility and relaxation in that part of the state and just hiking the various trails in Grandfather Mountain. So that's where we're headed, and I'm so excited about it.
Yeah, I went to school as an undergraduate in Boone at Appalachian State. And so I had a good time. An advantage of that is one of my PE classes was skiing. You can do that when you go to school in the mountains. So I actually learned how to ski there, and I just finished the trip to the mountains to observe what was going on with the 11th District race. And yeah, that confirmed I really do enjoy the mountains, and we will plan on heading out there, our family as well, sometime in the next couple of months.
Yeah, well, that's perfect. And actually, that brings us to what we're going to be discussing for part of this program, which is the 11th District. So kudos to you for that nice transition. as you well know, but maybe some of our audience doesn't know, we had a runoff election on the Republican ticket for NC-11, the 11th Congressional District. And this was a little bit unique for a variety of reasons, this runoff election and then the subsequent just head off between candidates Linda Bennett and candidate Madison Cawthorn. So, Andy, why don't you bring us up to speed on what it is about this particular election that's unique and our audience should be interested in following?
Well, there's a couple of things. And the first one I'll just touch on briefly is this election is kind of a dress rehearsal for what the state's going to be doing this fall in the general election. This is the first major election that we had with the coronavirus pandemic kind of hanging over our heads, and that's affecting how the counties are going about. Some people who had been poll workers had quit, so they had to get some replacements for that, and they had to change some procedures. So this had an effect. Interestingly, though, it didn't really have an effect on turnout. This was one of the, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but this is one of the highest turnout second primaries North Carolina, on the congressional level, North Carolina has ever had. And a big part of that was the enthusiasm for Madison Cawthorn. He had a lot going in his home county of Henderson in the first round, in the first primary back in March. Now, Bennett actually came in first place. She got a little over 20% there, but she didn't get anywhere near the 30% she needed to avoid the runoff. And so that allowed Cawthorn, who unexpectedly came in second place, to really build on that momentum. And that really helped him. It seems like this was really, there were elements of both kind of anti-Bennett, but this is more than anything else, a kind of groundswell of support for Cawthorn. That you don't see that often in races. So he's got a really strong, dedicated following behind him.
Yeah, that was something that really stuck out to me on this, but also in particular because of his age. And so Madison Cawthorn is only 24 years old right now. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? And so he, based on your article, you've written about this at nccivitas.org, you note that he'll be constitutionally eligible to serve on his 25th birthday in August. So, you know, sufficiently well before the election. But do we have any other, who are some of our other younger congressmen and women? I mean, I know AOC,
I haven't really kept up. He would be by far the youngest person to serve in modern history. There is some debate about how the age of some members of Congress, back at the start of the Republic, where perhaps they weren't keeping up with those things quite as closely. But there's not going to be anybody close to somebody that's going to essentially, if assuming that he wins in the November general election, which is, probable, this being the election.
Why is it probable?
Well, it's probable because this district tends to lean Republican. Even as you may recall, after the lawsuit, part of Asheville had previously been in another district. That part of Asheville was put back in, which makes it a little more Democratic. But this district is still, I think the Cook Political Report or Sabato's Crystal Ball, one of those, listed this district as a +9 Republican district. So while it's not impossible for a Democrat to win in the district, it would take a lot. And so far, at least, Cawthorn has shown himself to be a very formidable candidate. He overcame a whole host of obstacles to win the second primary. He had a number of big name endorsements were supporting Bennett. The Freedom Caucus PAC spent more than $1 million in the race, both in support of Bennett and against Cawthorn. The Freedom Caucus is a group of the more conservative members of Congress. So he had to push back, past a lot of that in order to overcome. And I don't see how he's going to just suddenly, lose sight of the prize after this and then just drop the ball after he's been doing so well so far.
Yeah, well, and let's put a pin on that because I want to talk a little bit more about what the second primary was like on this front in terms of the sheer volume of funding and endorsements that Bennett had. But before that, Madison Cawthorn, some might not know this, but he is at least partially paralyzed from the waist down, from what I'm aware of. And so when you're talking about a whole host of challenges that he's had to overcome, there's also that physical aspect of this that really, I would say, speaks to his ability and his willingness to really fight hard and not give up.
Right. I mean, he had been an athlete in high school, was in the process of trying to get into one of the service academies. I forget which one it was. I think it might have been Navy. Don't quote me on that. And then he was seriously injured in a car accident right at the end of his high school time, required major surgery, required a lot of physical therapy. Which he is still going through, I believe. And so, he had to overcome that really just to even get to this point where he is. And he has developed into a good public speaker. One of the things he has done on the side, in addition to his real estate investment business, is motivational speaking, trying to encourage people to do their best. And clearly he is taking the lead on that and really applying himself in the 11th district. Clearly this is going to be somebody that is going to bear watching over the next decades. I mean, he's still very early in his life.
Yeah, absolutely. He's got quite a bit of runway, it seems. And so this will be a fun race to watch. And one quick question, who's the Democratic candidate that he's going up against?
Oh, Mo, I've forgotten his last name.
Mo Davis, right?
Is that Mo Davis? Thank you very much. Yeah, he is a veteran. He easily won the Democratic primary for the 11th district. He's considered a solid candidate, so he's certainly not going to be any kind of pushover in the general election. But, you know, as we talked about before, you know, Cawthorn had to deal with a lot of things in this primary, not the least of which was that Bennett had gotten the endorsement of President Trump.
Wow.
In the lead-in to this election. And while President Trump's record of endorsements wasn't perfect, it was near perfect in Republican primaries. And so there's a whole, it was a little weird. If you look at their endorsement lists, Bennett had the kind of this top down. She was endorsed by a lot of Freedom Caucus members, Senator Ted Cruz, former 11th District Congressman Mark Meadows, who is now Donald Trump's chief of staff. And of course, President Trump himself. And of course, those are not unrelated. There has been reports that essentially what happened with that endorsement was that President Trump was urged to do so by Meadows, who in turn was urged to do so by Mark Meadows' wife, who is a friend of Linda Bennett. And I think a lot of the conduct of that rubbed local folks the wrong way, both with the way the endorsement happened and also the way that Mark Meadows dropped out at the very last, or decided not to run at the very last minute. And it was a real scramble for other candidates to run. There is a lot of folks believe that Bennett had gotten a heads up well ahead of time so that she could register for that race. And so if you look at Cawthorn, Cawthorn got the endorsement of most of the other candidates who had run in the 11th district and lost. He also racked up endorsements from local sheriffs. So if you look, if you go to their webpages, I don't know if Bennett's is still up, but if you look at their webpages and their list of endorsements, it's a whole different world. And it's clear that Cawthorn had the benefit of a lot more grassroots support. And I think that really goes a long way towards overcoming, I mean, even the endorsement of a sitting president.
Yeah, so it seems that's going to be something that we really want to watch going into November, is just whether or not this wave that Cawthorn has rode all the way to the Republican nomination will be something that he's able to finally secure in November over the Democrat, over Mo Davis. So, but let's go ahead and continue talking elections, but I want to talk about something else that I know our audience has been following throughout the years, and they know that Civitas talks a lot about voter ID, and you have written extensively on it and know a lot of the ins and outs of this. But first off, let me ask you, Andy, are we going to be required to show an ID in November when we go into the ballot box?
Almost certainly not. The voter ID bill that was passed to implement the constitutional amendment that North Carolina voters voted for in 2018 has been held up by two different courts, one a state appeals court and one a federal district court. And so far, the process of appealing that has proceeded at a glacial pace. So I would say it's highly unlikely at this point that we're going to see voter ID for in-person voting used this year. You know, how these cases will ultimately pan out, that remains to be seen, but it probably won't happen in time to have an influence on these elections.
So, you know, I think that a lot of people that voted in 2018 for the constitutional amendment for voter ID are just getting so frustrated over this holdup. And I know it's not a holdup on the legislature's part. It's going through the courts. But this is, have you ever seen something in our state, I guess, that's been fought over so extensively? I mean, I guess gerrymandering too, but.
The whole redistricting thing, obviously, it heats up a lot. North Carolina gets sued a lot at both parties. When they were in control, the Democrats had their districts that they drew in the early 2000s, if you will, tossed out by courts. And so that's a regular thing. But as far as like a continuous grind, this voter ID thing has probably been the biggest long-term fight. We've been going at it for nearly a decade now.
Yeah, it's North Carolina seems to provide the rest of the nation just a sort of blueprint for how to have extended legal battles over elections.
We seem to be
quite proficient at it now.
Yeah, we have. We still have a host of lawsuits going on related to coronavirus, lawsuits about voting machines. We've got one about voting machines. We've got those two on ID. I'm sure there's a couple of lawsuits out there that I have missed, but it seems to be a constant part. A big part of my job is figuring out who's suing whom at this point. So we definitely get that. And it's kind of, these lawsuits have pushed on certain issues. Part of it is that an earlier ID law had been struck down by courts. And part of the reasoning in both these cases is that most of the people who voted for that earlier law also voted for this law. And the reason that that's a big deal is that that allows the courts to have kind of a lower level of scrutiny. It lets them overturn laws easier because they can just assume that the legislature is being discriminatory in the law. And so they don't have to use the same kind of actually looking at the effect of the law and what it would do in the language itself. It makes it easier for judges to enjoin and overturn these laws. So it's really, part of it is, you know, an animus against the General Assembly, which I find weird, but that's part of the reason that they did. They also are talking about the fact that the voter ID law doesn't include, for example, IDs that are produced for public assistance, like say food stamps or public housing or that kind of thing. And that had been a big issue in both of the court cases.
Yeah, so essentially they got what they wanted and then they threw a fit because they didn't want to get what they wanted so they could continue throwing a bigger fit. Well, is that how?
Well, here's the interesting thing, because this is what happened in this. There's the big coronavirus compromise bill, H1169. There was a provision in there that allows for public assistance IDs, if they have pictures, to be used as IDs for voting. This is something that was mentioned in both court cases. This is something that Democrats had said that they wanted when the original ID law was passed in 2018. And lo and behold, as part of this bill, this compromise that had been worked out in the North Carolina House over several weeks, they got it. Now that form of ID can be included. And not all, I mean, this is still passed by pretty wide, you know, bipartisan majorities, but there was about half of the Democrats in the legislature bolted from their support of this bill because they're getting a provision that they wanted. And the reason they were against this isn't because they don't think it's a good idea. They clearly do. It's something that they had argued for. But they were more concerned about keeping the lawsuits going than right. with actually getting policy that they wanted. They think, well, if we use the courts, we can get all of what we want rather than compromise through the legislative system, you know, backed up by the voters in North Carolina through our, you know, elected legislators.
That's so sad to me, just because it really is a very vivid and immediate example of putting politics and partisanship over what's best for North Carolinians and over democracy. When you think about just how this voter ID bill was, it was clear where North Carolinians stood on it. So that's shameful, in my opinion.
Yeah, it was pretty bad when you're going against your own policy preference just because you think you could stick it to the other side in the courts better. It's weird.
So now, speaking of the fall elections, though, so it doesn't look like we're going to have to show voter ID, but what do you think's going to happen in terms of turnout? Do you think we're going to see a lot of absentee or mail-in ballots? And kind of explain the politics behind that and why it's such a charged issue.
It's a little odd how things are going to fall. I think we're going to have a near record, if not a record, turnout. The interest in this election is clearly very high. Our voter registration is a little off pace, but I expect that to pick up as we get closer to the November election. What we have right now is the State Board of Elections Executive Director Karen Brinson Bell had, as far as I know, this was just a guess, maybe an educated guess, but she had in a memo she sent in April to the General Assembly said that she expected about 30 to 40% of North Carolina voters to vote by mail, absentee by mail. That would be a huge change. We normally do about 4 to 5% mail voting. North Carolina has a pretty strong system of early voting. A lot of people like to vote on election day, and mail had generally been seen as an option for people that, for whatever reason, just couldn't do one of those other two. In-person voting is also generally considered more secure than absentee by mail voting because the ballot never leaves the voting place, which is pretty important. A lot of the instances that we've seen, such as the 9th District incident, what happened in the 9th District in 2018 was because those ballots were going into people's homes so that political operatives could try to go to the homes and then, collect those ballots. You can't really do that when people are voting in person. Anyway, so they're estimating 30 to 40%. Our own research that we've done here on Civitas, both through polling, through looking at absentee ballot requests so far, and what happened recently in the 11th District second primary, indicates that you're really looking at closer to 10 to 15% mail ballot turnout. And if the state is wrong about how many people are going to vote each way, that could have an impact on the elections. If you think a lot of people are going to vote by mail, you're not going to invest as much time, money, effort in getting, cleaning materials, masks, renting out larger polling places for people to vote in person. And so you could end up, if the state makes a decision that a lot of people are going to go by mail and it turns out to be wrong, you could end up with the kind of long lines that we've seen in places like California and Georgia in their primaries. And that's something that we really want to avoid, having people stuck in line for 2, 3, 4 hours waiting to vote. And so it's really important that we get this number right. Now, if it turns out that things change and that you end up with a lot more people voting by mail, or at least it looks like it, then we can make adjustments. But so far, the numbers just don't support what the state board says is going to happen.
Right. And so what if you were on the state board, what information are you looking for to be able to make this determination?
There's a couple of things. I mean, one, the polling is good because it gives you a random sample or representative sample, depending on how you do your methods. And that gives you a good idea of what's going on. There are some interesting differences in the polling, by the way. For example, Democrats, about 20% say they plan to vote by mail, and Republicans, it's only around 4%. As it turned out, in the 11th District second primary, about 3% of the folks voted absentee by mail. And so that lines up pretty nicely with the results we had in the poll. It also tells you that some counties may have up to 30% voting. If you have areas that are very Democratic, especially white Democrats, because in the poll also African-Americans say they're going to vote in person at a slightly higher rate than whites. So say like your Orange counties, which is a very liberal, very white county by North Carolina standards, you could expect a whole lot of absentee by mail ballots. In some of the western counties, a lot less. These counties need to plan accordingly. Another early indicator, although there are some problems with it, is comparing absentee ballot requests now to the same point in 2016. For example, Wake County, they're doing about, in middle of June, last time I checked, they had about 2.5 times more requests this year than last year. So that's looking at about a 10 to 12% mail turnout rate, if those numbers hold. I'm in the process of asking every county in North Carolina for their numbers, so hopefully we'll have that. But the county should definitely take a look at, you know, how many mail ballot requests are coming in and adjust accordingly. Don't just depend on what the state board is telling you.
Yeah, I think that's some wise sage advice. Look at the data, look at the historical turnouts, including, like you said, that most recent election. Well, Andy, this has been very insightful, and I love having you on because you just know so much as it pertains to this this niche but very important aspect of North Carolina policy, which is elections. And so that's really, really helpful information, especially going into such a pivotal election season as we are. But I wanted to close with one question for you following that theme of Independence Day, and wanted to ask you, what is your favorite American patriotic song?
I would have to say America the Beautiful.
Yes.
That's a good one. I mean, frankly, I don't want to get in like the debate about changing the national anthem, but if we ever did, if we ever did, that would probably be my first vote for a new national anthem. I mean, Lee Greenwood aside, that's a good song too, but
yes.
I think that really captures, you know, the mm-hmm. spirit of the country at our best. And so, yeah, I really like that one.
Yeah, that's a really aspirational song. I agree with you. I think it's a beautiful one, and I always find myself humming it around this time of year. So anyways, if you are listening to this either before or after Independence Day, I either hope you will have a good one or did have a good one. And thank you so much for joining us this week. You all have a wonderful day. Take care.